Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's day three at the Republican National Convention. We sent our fabulous intern, Meghna. She's from WCPN. She's Phoebe Petrovic. We sent her last night outside the arena to gather sound. Now, there were the usual bongo players. And, of course, there were protesters and a big replica of Donald Trump's head, complete with orange hair. It's called the Trump Hut, and people went inside.
It's just weird to be in here, weird enough to, like, want to conversate.
We were also inspired a bit by the Occupy movement, and we started thinking about the idea that you could actually occupy Donald Trump's head. And so if you sit inside there, it gives you a bit of that feeling. It's empty right now.
What we have here is cereal box Trump Flakes and Clinton Crunch. It's a light play on a serious topic. So the Trump Flakes, we do have him here. The Flakes do kind of look like his hair a little bit.
I think both candidates stink. And this young lady, it's called a voter survival kit, and that's a clothespin. You can use this in a voting booth because it's going to smell so bad.
Congratulations, Dad. We love you.
Yeah,
we
did it. And those last sounds, Trump supporters outside the arena cheering as they watch him be nominated on a big TV screen. Here now, political analyst Paris Denard is here. He's a Republican strategist, a Trump supporter. So, Paris, craziness outside. But what do you think about inside? I'm thinking when we first started on this election road trip,
yeah.
You know, you told us, oh, I don't know, I think that a more appropriate candidate would be, for instance, a sitting governor.
Right.
You soon became a Trump supporter. Last night, against all odds, you watch him nominated.
It was an amazing moment, I think, for Donald Trump, his family, and all the persons who had worked from day one to get him to that point. What's amazing is that he really factually beat 16 other people.
Yes,
yeah. And they're in huge names, long-term names, major people in the Republican Party to become the nominee, despite the fact that there were people still at the convention days before trying to thwart that effort.
Yeah.
He overcame the 16, overcame the Never Trump movement, and he's now our nominee. It's an amazing journey.
It sure is, but some people say, you know, getting this week, this portion of the journey hasn't been all that pretty. Now, we just want to take care of some business here. The Trump campaign is acknowledging that some of Melania Trump's speech Monday night parts were lifted from Michelle Obama's speech in 2008. In a statement, speechwriter Meredith McIver accepted responsibility. She says she's offered her resignation. It was rejected by Donald Trump. You know, we've talked about this, perhaps in your view, ad nauseum, that some Republican operatives are slack-jawed, that's a quote, over the handling of this. It took so long to just get to that. But I want to put it aside because you've expressed your thoughts on it and want to move on. What about, though, the fact that then last night the message was supposed to be make America work again, and we heard very little about jobs in the economy. We heard jail Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, that was an interesting point that I also noticed as well. But I think what's happening is the Trump campaign, the convention staff is trying to get as much time focused on who Donald Trump is as a person. We've known Hillary Clinton, Secretary Clinton, for 40-some-odd years in the public sphere. We only know Donald Trump by how the Clinton campaign is trying to define him and what we've seen on The Apprentice and what we've seen of him as a mogul, as a businessman. So each opportunity, each night that they get to highlight him as a father, highlight him in his personal story, to really connect with the American people, the thought that he was a blue-collar billionaire, you know, those images and those messages, I think that's what they're trying to seize upon.
Yeah, but, you know, we saw one of your colleagues, another analyst, Republican analyst, Margaret Hoover, you know, the descendant of a
President Hoover.
She kind of fell apart this morning on CNN. She said, this is a circus. They are not talking about any of the policies that counteract the Democratic policies.
Right, but I think Margaret's, first of all, not on the Trump train. And secondly, I think the important thing is that what the convention is for. The convention is about messaging, about who the candidate is. We have a new candidate that people do not know, that really people do not understand who he is in this new role as a political figure and as the Republican nominee. So traditionally, you would be talking about policies, and traditionally, you'd be doing that and going back to their record. He doesn't have a record. Mm. He doesn't have a policy platform for years of being in the public sphere. So what does he have? His personal story that he's trying to share and try to manage it for himself, because he was successful in the campaign saying, Little Marco. He was successful saying low energy Jeb. Now he's got to do the same for himself, define who he is and why he wants to be president.
We should say that Speaker Paul Ryan was there last night and did touch on the economy a bit.
True.
Let's listen.
Progressives like to talk, like our president, like to talk forever about poverty in America. And if high-sounding talk did any good, we'd have overcome those deep problems long ago. This explains why, under the most liberal president we have had so far, poverty in America is worse, especially for our fellow citizens who are promised better and who need it most.
You know, I just want to, you know, point out that he did speak of poverty, but he also was one of the, you know, the few establishment Republicans to be there. Senate Leader Mitch McConnell was booed when he got on the stage, and Paul Ryan, that was a very cool reception for him. Is it kind of over for that wing of the party?
I won't say that it's over, but I will say that you have two, you have the establishment, you have the grassroots, and the grassroots do not like party establishment types. And the party establishment types were the ones that were running that Donald Trump beat. So it's sort of normal to see that type of reaction that you get from people who they feel that they cannot trust and they feel that have let him down. I don't feel that way, but this is the time that we have to unify. This is the time we have to say, okay. And I believe that's what Speaker Ryan and Mitch McConnell were trying to do yesterday, saying we can work with Donald Trump. We can get this agenda done on the House side, and we can get the Supreme Court nominees that we want on the Senate side. So I think they were trying to unify both fractions. And Mitch McConnell had his own problem when he ran in the Senate race, remember, with establishment in the grassroots. And so he's trying to mend fences, and we'll move forward, hopefully united, to do so.
Well, speaking of mending fences, Ted Cruz is scheduled to speak tonight. He has not yet truly formally endorsed Donald Trump, and he didn't show his speech, apparently, to the committee. And we heard people on Fox and Friends this morning complaining about that. Fox and Friends people saying, why wasn't Ted Cruz, why didn't they demand to see his speech? Why are they allowing him to speak without seeing it?
Well, if you want another empty chair Clint Eastwood moment, you better ask to see that speech. I mean, it's a very daring thing that you to do for someone like a Ted Cruz who has historically gone off script and done it and marched by the beat of his own drum. So it's going to be very, it's a dangerous move, but hopefully the message that Ted Cruz sends out to the people that are watching is party unity and that he's 100% behind Donald Trump. If not, it's inappropriate for him to do that. And there's been other candidates like John Kasich who's not here. And I know for a fact that Governor Kasich, much to my surprise, has been thwarting the efforts of some people to speak on the convention from Ohio. So this convention has got to, we've got to unify around Donald Trump.
And just very briefly, you can see the time there. We've got about 30 seconds. There's an outbreak of norovirus among the, you know, through the California delegation. Donald Trump, an infamous germaphobe. You know, might he stay away even more?
He won't be kissing the babies from California tonight.
That's right. Here in our political analyst, Paris Denard, also a Republican strategist and a Donald Trump supporter. We'll be having reports from you all week, so we can't wait to hear what you think when Donald Trump does perhaps enter in a bubble or something.
It'll be a gold bubble if he does.
Yes, to speak. Paris, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, a lot of money is being spent this week at the Republican convention in Cleveland, just like for any major event. And that's good news for merchants, no doubt. But what if you're a young delegate from out of town and you're in need of a hotel room, transportation, and food? Where do you get the money? Soraya Shockley of Here and Now contributor Youth Radio has this profile of one delegate who went to GoFundMe as his first stop.
Is that Chris Wallace?
My name's William Carter.
This was Will Carter's first day in Cleveland.
I just met Chris Wallace. He's on Fox News every Sunday. So I'm pretty excited.
Meeting famous political figures and pundits is one of the many reasons why the 18-year-old ran to become a Georgia delegate back in March.
At that point, it was all tunnel vision for me. I didn't care what they said. I wanted that delegate spot.
But it came with a price tag.
After I had won, I learned about the financial responsibility of being a delegate. I've almost spent close to $3,000, and I'll probably, by the end of this week, have spent close to $5,000.
There's no delegate plane. They buy tickets and fly coach just like the rest of us. At least most of the young ones do. The RNC books huge blocks of hotel rooms, but the delegates pick up the tab for that too. There are about 2,500 delegates. Add to that the alternates, volunteers, lobbyists, police, and press like me, and you end up with about 50,000 visitors to the Cleveland area this week. John Aldrich, political science professor at Duke, says the RNC is hoping all those dollars translate to more than a few swing state votes.
They hope to have a lot of good press about how important this convention was for our city, how much it's helped, look how much money it's brought in, look how much tourism trade will be up, and so on and so forth.
Aldrich says there's little evidence the convention bump translates to an actual bump on election day.
On the other hand, it's worth a shot. It's going to be someplace. It might as well be the place where, if all goes well, it'll be at least marginally helpful. It's simply, it might help.
It might help is what Will Carter, the 18-year-old delegate we heard from earlier, was hoping when he started a GoFundMe page. He set a goal of $10,000 to help pay for the trip, but only raised $1,000 from the crowdfunding site. No matter, says Will, because for a young delegate who hopes to someday be president, the convention offers a chance to be discovered.
I don't know if it's possible, but my hope is that they'll go, hey, wow, this kid's really young. Hey, would you like to speak? And I'd be like, heck yes. That's what it would be like in my little, you know, uncomplicated, perfect world.
Even if that doesn't happen, Will says, thanks to this story, his other goal for the convention has been realized. Making it into the national media. For Here and Now, I'm Soraya Shockley in Cleveland.
And Soraya's story was produced by Youth Radio.
It's day three of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. As if people need reminding, everybody's been paying quite a bit of attention. Tonight, VP nominee Mike Pence will speak. So will Marco Rubio. I think his voice is going to be fed into the arena. Ted Cruz will be here. They're, of course, two of Trump's toughest former rivals. Observing it all, about 15,000 journalists, including foreign correspondents, reporting for outlets around the world. Three of them join us now. James Andre is senior correspondent for the television network France 24. James, welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
We also have Mark Bassett, U.S. correspondent for El País. That's a daily newspaper based in Madrid. They also publish editions for Brazil and Latin America. Mark, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And sitting between you, Gary O'Donohue, Washington correspondent for the BBC. Gary, hello.
Thanks, Robin. Hi.
And I want to start with you, Gary, our BBC partner. We well know that Donald Trump has already gotten into some hot water. The Muslim London mayor, I think, has banned him after Trump talking about banning Muslims from coming to the U.S. What's the reaction in Britain to Donald Trump getting this far, the nominee?
Well, of course, Britain's been involved in its own political soap opera for the last few months, Robin, as you've seen, what with Brexit and the exit of one prime minister and the chaos in the opposition Labour Party. So nothing really surprises, but there is a fascination with Donald Trump in Britain. More than 500,000 people signed a petition trying to stop him coming to the country, which ended up even potentially getting talked about in Parliament. So, yeah, there is an absolute fascination with what's happening. But I think there's a recognition, too, that he has tapped into something that's not just a phenomenon in the United States. This anti-politician sentiment is present in Britain. I know Mark will tell you it's present in Spain as well. This is something that's happening everywhere, and it's something people are sort of, I think, struggling to understand and also fascinated with at the same time.
Well, you mentioned Mark. Mark Bassett's again with El País there in Madrid. Are people who want to exit Brexit, who feel that there should be boundaries and walls, and they've had it with what they see as too much too many refugees, too much immigration, are they identifying with Donald Trump's followers here in the U.S.?
Yes, I think that in Europe there are a lot of movements and politicians which have points in common with Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a very, and is seen from the outside as a very American phenomenon. Only in America someone like Donald Trump can get to be a candidate to the presidency. But it's also a global phenomenon with many points in common with the Front National in France, with in some aspects with the Brexit movement, and with populist movements left and right, some of them in Spain as well, which are tapping into the fears of globalization, for instance. Also right-wing movements who are using stoking fears about immigration. And in this sense, Trump, I think, is very American, but also very European.
Well, James, from France, weigh in on that. And first, our sincere condolences for just the horror that your country is seeing, your nodding acceptance of that. You know, just terrible. But how are people in France viewing the Trump candidacy?
Well, you know, people are very surprised at the result, the fact that Trump is being nominated right now. But the fact of the matter is, you know, we have a very large Muslim community in France, and it's true that it's been a real challenge over the past few months. I mean, we've had November 13th, you know, the attack on the Bataclan in Paris. Now we have Nice just a few days ago. But despite all that, people are still shocked at the idea that you could, you know, for example, ban Muslims from the United States, as Donald Trump has said it, until you figure things out. That's another shocker in a way. I mean, it's a very unclear statement. So, you know, we're trying in France right now, our politicians are trying to bind society together. They've realized that the whole point is to destroy the French society, to break it into two parts, Muslims and non-Muslims, and they're trying to prevent that. So it's true that seeing this kind of rhetoric here in the United States from Donald Trump is kind of shocking to part of the audience in France. But on the other hand, it's important to remember we have, you know, Marine Le Pen, you were saying, what about her? She's also tapping into that sentiment, but she would probably not go that far.
Yeah. By the way, you are working for France 24 in France by way of... That is not a French accent.
My mother's British.
Okay, there you go. Well, let's listen to former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani speaking at the convention on Monday.
In the last 7 months, there have been 5 major Islamic terrorist attacks on us and our allies. We must not be afraid to define our enemy. It is Islamic extremist terrorism.
And a big crowd cheer. Anybody pick up? Who wants to jump in on that? How is, you know, this is playing off what we've been talking about, but start with you, Gary, again, BBC. How's that being heard?
Well, I think, I mean, one of the big motivating factors behind the Brexit vote was this fear about the movement of people. There's been a lot made of people crossing borders in Europe, coming to France and to other places, Belgium and Britain. And that was undoubtedly one of the big fears that played into the no vote, the vote to leave the EU. Because, of course, the European Union, one of its fundamental freedoms is this freedom of movement. It's about tearing down borders, and it is easy to move across, and people don't like that because... Britain particularly has experienced high levels of migration. And for many, many years, a lot of politicians in Britain ignored that. Mm. And they failed to see, I think, that, how do you put it, actually quite normal, reasonable, nice people were worried about some aspects of these levels of migration. Mm. They were frightened to say so because they would be called racist, but they were worried about the impact on public services like education, like hospitals, like the question of housing, the amount of housing in a small island like we've got. And politicians have paid a price for that in many ways, for not realizing there were reasonable concerns. And the Islamic threat, I think, plays into that too, because, of course, Britain, not on the scale of France, has suffered, but Britain has had its 7/7, where we had 51 people killed on the underground in London by bombs. And, of course, we had a soldier slain on the streets of London just in 2013.
The machete attack, But, James, I want to switch gears and talk about a different aspect of the Donald Trump candidacy. This is a beautiful family that, you know, that has starred on television shows. It's when you see the lineup of the Donald Trump extended family and Mike Pence, the VP nominee, and his wife and daughter, you feel like someone has to tell them how to put their feet, because the Trump women know how to stand like models. And there's something else reverberating out of that family. How's that being received in France?
Well, I think, you see, this is something that is very, very different from the way we do politics in France. Like, for example, we'd never see the son or the daughter of a politician running for president on the stand talking. Probably you might get a glimpse of his or her spouse, but that's very much it. So it's true that to us it's very remarkable to see all this, let's say, family marketing around the candidate. That's something which culturally is completely different.
You're not just getting a candidate. You're getting a dynasty and a corporation.
Exactly. But you see, the dynasty thing is, like, for example, in France, like you could say maybe the platform of Hillary Clinton is more palatable to, like, French public, because there's less, you know, some positions are less extreme and maybe less shocking to the French public. But on the other hand, she is seen as a member of a dynasty. She's the wife of Bill Clinton. She was, you know, she was the foreign affairs secretary. She obviously is very well known to the French public. So funnily enough, where there was, like, for example, huge excitement about Barack Obama, about Michelle Obama, for example, that's a family, as you say, the family thing. Mm-hmm. That's a family that is really loved in France. People, you know, look up to this family. But and the Trump thing is maybe slightly different in its context, but it's true that the dynastic thing is something which is quite shocking to the French.
It's very shocking to us in Britain as well, because if you... I mean, usually in Britain, if you start parading your family out there, then that's a politician that's in trouble, right? This is someone who's trying to deflect criticism. Usually at a convention like this in Britain, the leader would make their speech and the spouse might pop up on the stage and give a quick peck on the cheek and a little wave to the crowd, then they'd disappear. You certainly wouldn't parade children every night of the week on the stage, because politicians in Britain would believe that's asking for trouble. That's opening the book, creating open season for the press to go after and examine the children, and that's the last thing they want.
Well, these people are open books. They've written books about themselves. But Mark, and not just this idea that this was a television show host, but our process, that this takes a week, that the Democrats will take a week. That it's been a year. How do Spaniards care at all about that?
It's difficult to explain this, that the electoral campaign lasts for more than a year. Mm-hmm. I've been covering this since, approximately May last year, May 2015. So this long process is purely American, as is the conventions. It's a television show, mainly.
It is a television show. Well, and just very briefly, we've got about a minute here. And James, I'll just ask you. We're also seeing real division between Americans. There's huge differences between the parties this time around. Does that concern people in France?
Oh, well, quite clearly. I mean, people in France are concerned about the American election, that's for sure. But as far as division is concerned, it's absolutely incredible to hear things on the floor that we do here, such as, for example, you know, talking about Hillary Clinton.
Senator Jail.
Yeah, you know, Senator Jail. I actually heard on the floor somebody say, lynch her. And you ask yourself the question when you're there, you're thinking, okay, is this just a big show? Or what would happen if Hillary Clinton actually walked into this room? Would she literally be lynched by these people? You see like this concentrated, you know, mix of people which sharing these ideas, and it's quite surprising for a French journalist.
And I think it's because you've got this polarization in America. In Europe, you've got multiple.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that, and that chilling thought. Gary O'Donohue just speaking, Washington correspondent for the BBC. Before that, James André from France 24, Mark Bassett's El País in Madrid. Thank you for the view from abroad, and we hear the astonishment of politics. Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be made in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
It's being called one of the biggest e-commerce deals in recent years. European consumer goods giant Unilever is reportedly paying $1 billion cash for the California-based Dollar Shave Club. That's the men's grooming startup that sells online subscriptions to low-cost men's shaving products, and it's also known for its irreverent marketing.
And do you think your razor needs a vibrating handle, a flashlight, a back scratcher, and 10 blades? Your handsome-ass grandfather had one blade and polio.
Funny or maybe not. Dollar Shave Company was founded in 2011 with the backing of startup incubator Science, and projected revenues for 2016 are more than $200 million. So what will the deal mean for both Unilever, Dollar Shave Club, and consumers? CNN's Maggie Lake joins us from CNN's New York studios. Maggie, welcome back to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So why is this deal such an important one?
Yeah, for a couple reasons, I think. First of all, it really shows how truly disruptive Dollar Shave Club has been. You know, as you mentioned, they kind of came out of nowhere, but they hit a nerve, and men were really getting fed up with how expensive shaving products have become. All of us, actually, if anyone's had to go out and buy them.
You don't like spending $9 per replacement
exactly.
blade?
I refuse to, actually. I make my husband buy all his own. But, you know, they really hit a nerve. And in the beginning, in fact, they were so overwhelmed, their servers crashed, and they've quickly gained market share. They have an estimated 8% 5% of the market. Sounds small, but this is a $3 billion market. So it underscores their success. And the other significant thing about this is it really ups the ante in the war now between Unilever and Procter & Gamble, which, of course, owns Gillette.
Right. And, I mean, Unilever is such a huge company. Maybe you haven't – people might have not heard of it directly, but you've definitely heard of their products.
Axe, right.
Dove, Ben and Jerry's, Vaseline, like you're somewhere in your house, you've got a Unilever
yes,
product.
Yes.
So, I mean, so what does it mean for Unilever beyond the Procter & Gamble sort of jab there?
Well, I think a lot of people are worried when you see that headline. If you are a fan of Dollar Shave Club, what does this mean? Our price is going to go up now that this conglomerate has a hold of it. It doesn't look like that at first. In the press release, Unilever, not specific, but the founder and CEO of Dollar Shave Club, Michael Dubin, is going to continue to run the company. And the understanding is he's going to continue to operate it as a direct-to-consumer razor business, as an independent entity. Now, whether that changes down the line, you know, you always have to worry about that. But right now, it seems like Unilever is much more interested in getting market share, establishing that direct sales relationship with customers than it is on pushing up prices or trying to, you know, hike prices. And so this really gives it a stake in an area where it wasn't present. It wasn't really in the razor market.
Yeah, you know, and I'm also looking at that $1 billion in cash. I mean, that's got to be good news for the shareholders of
Dollar Shave
Club.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Yes. I mean, well, it's the investors in Unilever, I think, that are a little worried about this, and not because of the price tag, even though they are paying a premium. Jeffrey's analyst described this deal as Unilever parking their tanks on Procter & Gamble's lawn in one of their most profitable categories. What does that mean? Well, you see companies engage in this kind of competitive war. You tend to see prices go down, not up. That's great for us as consumers, but for investors, they worry about what that means for profits. And in fact, firms were out today reminding us that we did see this happen back in 2013. These two companies were duking it out in the hair care category, and it hit their profits. Yeah. So that's really what investors are a little bit worried about here.
Well, we'll see what happens. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Great to talk with you, Maggie. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Cleveland, which put out the welcome mat for Republicans this week and also welcomes refugees, thousands. But more important, Cleveland is one of the most successful cities in settling refugees. Just 8% of the city's refugees are still on public assistance after 2 years. That's lower than the national average. And 73% of refugees in Cleveland have jobs after 2 years. Take Mohammed, helping a customer at Shaker Beauty Supply in Cleveland Heights.
How are you doing today?
Good, how are you?
I'm good.
Mohammed is a Muslim Syrian refugee. He came to Cleveland in March. He still has family there and doesn't want us to use his full name. But in Syria, he worked in a legal office, was training to be a lawyer when the office closed because of the violence. We spoke through interpreter Mark Rodney.
When I lost my job, I sat in the house for a while, and there began to be more violence in the area. So the Syrian army came to the neighborhood that we lived in, and we weren't able to go outside because of the resistance people that were there. After there were bombings in our area, people from outside came to our neighborhood. So I went to Jordan and requested to be a refugee there. I was in Jordan for 4 years and then was accepted as a refugee and then was brought to America. And thank God I was here. I'm able to have a job and to express my opinion freely without any problems. Here in America, I feel like I'm a human.
So grateful to be here. You've also been hearing, though, a lot of the language in the presidential campaign, including the Republican candidate, would bar you from coming into this country. Your thoughts as you're hearing that conversation and that debate?
طبعاً أنا أحب كل المواطنين الأمريكيين ما بكره السيد ترامب لكن السيد ترامب عنده بعض العنصرية.
Of course, I love the American people, and I hope that Mr. Donald Trump would not end up leading this country, a country where people love democracy and freedom, and I prefer Hillary Clinton to be the leader.
And you're allowed to have that opinion here. But what would you say to Americans who are afraid? They see the attacks overseas. They see the attacks here perpetrated by people who might have been inspired by ISIS. They are afraid. They see attacks made by Muslims. They think Muslims hate Americans, and they want to ban Muslims.
الفكر المتطرف أو الإرهاب ما له محصور بالمسلمين.
So the idea of extremism or terrorism is not within the scope of Islam. ISIS is against Islam. They're not Muslims. All of the people in Syria hate ISIS. They're killing a lot of people in Syria, so the Syrian people really don't like ISIS.
And what do you think, as you watch the political process unfold? We have a convention here this week, a convention the week after. You're watching the American democracy at work. What do you think about it?
It's great that Americans can express their opinion, and if they were afraid, they wouldn't be able to express those opinions. If I were restricted from expressing my opinion, I wouldn't be able to do this interview right now, so it's great to have that freedom in America.
And what is your hope? What's his goal?
Well, بصراحة أنا أول ما
So when I first heard that I was accepted as a refugee, my first thought was that I want to finish my studies, which is international law.
Do you plan on becoming an American citizen?
Yes, I want to be an American citizen, and I will be an American citizen. I'm treating this land like it's mine, and I want to be a participating citizen in the future. I feel very sad, of course, like anyone would, leaving my country. I hope that the war could end today, but it seems like it's going to continue. I feel sad about that, but at the same time, I'm very happy and comfortable here and thankful.
So, why does Mohammed stand such a good chance of succeeding? Well, for one thing, there are more than a dozen refugee agencies in Ohio, but they work together with teams that go search out jobs, and they find willing employers. Danielle Drake is with one of the agencies, Us Together.
The refugees here do a lot better. They are employed quicker, usually within 5 months, way above the national average. And I think it speaks a lot to how welcoming our city is.
How do you square that with the attitude of a huge chunk of the electorate now that, you know, refugees, immigrants are a burden?
This is the land of immigrants, so clearly I think immigrants are not a burden. They built this country with their blood, sweat, and tears. So I think anyone that says immigrants and refugees are a burden has never truly spent time with an immigrant or a refugee and does not see what they're doing to make this country better.
Well, but just give us some stats to back that up when it comes to Cleveland.
We actually did an economic impact study in 2012 and found that our return on investment on refugee resettlement is 10 to 1. So for every single dollar that my agency or another agency spends on refugees, they're putting $10 back into the local economy by paying taxes, working, buying houses, buying cars, and starting small businesses.
Then there's the other concern, and it's being expressed this week at the Republican convention. Burden on the economy is one thing, but security issue is another, especially when it comes to Muslims. You resettled Muhammad and others. What do you tell Clevelanders about why they should not be afraid of Muslims coming to the U.S. from places like Syria, where Muhammad came from, where there is ISIS, there is a reborn al-Qaeda?
I think that the truth is the best thing to educate people with. Refugees go through a 13-point security and background screening. Refugees from the Middle East go through additional security screenings that refugees from other countries maybe don't have to go through. So if someone is looking to harm our country, they're not coming through the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program. They're just not. Some people wait 18 to 20 years to get into this country as a refugee.
And just talk about Muhammad. You know, we have the language barrier, but I saw his face light up when he talked about being here. He talked about his work. And he's somebody who was studying law, and now he's, this is a great store, but now he's stocking beauty supplies.
His story is very similar to what I see every day. We resettle refugees that have PhDs, that were doctors, that were lawyers, that work as sales clerks and drive trucks. And they are maybe not happy that they have to, you know, lose all of that education or that it doesn't transfer, but they're willing to take any job. I have one Iraqi refugee client that him and his wife both had PhDs. His English was not at that level that he could teach in a university here when he first arrived, but he worked on his English, he practiced, he drove a truck for 2 years, and now he's teaching Arabic classes at a local university.
Do you see some irony that the RNC is here in Cleveland, which has one of the most successful refugee settlement programs in the country?
Yes. I mean, I think it does open up opportunities to educate people and to go out and talk about why refugees are good for the city and the country.
Have you tried to maybe talk directly with RNC members? Come see our program.
I personally have not.
How many refugees have you settled here? And I'm assuming they are largely Muslim from war-torn countries right now.
We actually resettle refugees from all over the world. So we're still resettling Bhutanese refugees that have lived in camps in Nepal since 1991. We resettle many, many refugees from sub-Saharan Africa, as well as the Middle East, Afghanistan, Syria, and Iraq. The city of Cleveland welcomes over 800 refugees each year. And then we think that we have an additional 100 to 200 secondary migrants. So those are refugees that get resettled in another city, hear how great and welcoming Cleveland is, how affordable our rents are, and then they move to Cleveland. So maybe around 1,000 a year are coming.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah. I mean, it is, but it's not. You know, in the 70s and the 80s, the U.S. welcomed over 250,000 refugees every year, and now we're only doing 85,000.
And that, I'm sure, included post-Vietnam.
Correct. Yeah. And we did it safely, without any issues, without any security issues. So clearly, we can do it again.
Danielle Drake of the Ohio Refugee Resettlement Agency, Us Together. We also spoke with Mohammed, a recent refugee from Syria, already working at Shaker Beauty Supply in Cleveland Heights, as we look at some of the issues of the campaign as they play out here in Cleveland.
Robin, I just have to ask you a quick question. Do you think there's anything that says summer more than ice cream and popsicles?
You know what, Megan, I got to tell you, I don't, but we are so cold here in the queue. It's something I wasn't really thinking about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so you've had to be inside covering the Republican convention. But here and now, resident chef Kathy Gunst joins me in the studio with a bunch of cool sweets to celebrate summer. Kathy, great to see you as
Megna.
Always.
Hi, Robin. We miss you.
Hi, Kathy. Well, you know, don't pity me. I know you've got ice cream there.
Oh, yes, we do.
But here, you know what we have? I said we've been freezing. But we tweeted out for public radio fleeces from WCPN. They brought them to us, which is perfect because we also begged for ice cream from Cleveland's own Mitchell's Ice Cream. They are here. I've got Mitchell's homemade ice cream events captain, Mike Wynn. Mike,
Hi.
Just tell us real quick. We've got Kathy Gunst about to talk ice cream.
Hi, Kathy.
Kathy
Hi
is
there.
A huge organics friend. Tell us about your ice cream.
Oh, this is the ice cream for you. All our dairy comes from grass-fed cows. We use as many local ingredients as possible, especially seasonally. We have a lot of great herbs and produce available with lavender, and our fresh mint come from Mulberry Creek Herb Farm.
Oh, Kathy.
I never thought I'd want to be where you are, Robin. But boy, that sounds pretty good.
Mike, can you send it to Boston? That's what I want.
Hey, we're okay here.
We are actually more than okay. Robin, I've actually started eating the ice cream that Kathy brought during the break. I couldn't
good,
wait.
That's what it's for.
Kathy, tell us what you've got here. These are amazing looking treats.
So quickly, I mean, boy, I just feel like the world needs sweetening this week.
Yeah.
So here we have a lot of sugar. Let's start with the ice cream. I've got a homemade hot fudge sauce using lots of dark chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
And then I picked some raspberries and blueberries from my garden this morning. So you want to talk local. You want to talk fresh. It's happening right here. So that
I
is
may
just,
be unable to talk because I'm just going to eat
it's
this.
It's fine.
Okay?
We'll just keep going. A good old vanilla ice cream with a hot fudge that I just want to let you know is about four ingredients. You put in a pot. You heat it. You simmer it for 5 minutes. You honestly cannot mess it up. So that is a winner.
So the four ingredients, chocolate.
Chocolate, creamer half and half, you know, all the good stuff.
Okay.
What do you think, you know? There's not kale in there.
Well, that's the other fun thing about these recipes is that they're quick and easy, but
well,
they pack
that's
a
the
punch.
Goal. Summer, you don't want to be in the kitchen. The other one might be more extraordinary. So I have a caramel gelato there, but what I made was a sea salt pistachio caramel. And again, not the scary kind of caramel where you have to watch the butter and the sugar bubble away and you're scared to touch it. You take brown sugar, you take some butter, and you let it cook down with a little Karo syrup, you know, corn syrup, and that's it. You add a little bit of water.
So, Robin, Kathy knows
jealous
this because she saw me, but I practically passed out when I tried this. It is so delicious.
Super buttery.
I know that it is because it's Kathy, but I will see you your Sundays and your sauces and raise you the Gipper from Mitchell's Ice Cream, which I have in front of me. Now, tell me what you've done here, Mike. You've got different kinds of ice creams because of the Republican primary. The Gipper is?
The Gipper is a red raspberry topping trickling down over vanilla bean ice cream with a side of Jelly Bellies, sort of an old school twist. Reminds me of some old movies. Morning in America is sort of a simpler time kind of vibe.
Okay,
take
that sounds amazing. How about this? I have three popsicles here. No sugar added. All fresh fruit. We've got a mango, so I got mango juice, and there's chunks of fresh, ripe mango in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I have them in these really fun popsicle molds. The second one is watermelon lime with chunks of watermelon.
Yeah.
And the third one is a frozen yogurt with a little maple syrup and fresh blueberries. None of these have added sugar. It has that little bit of maple syrup in the yogurt. These are great projects for kids, great afternoon, cool you down on a hot summer day. And again, two steps. You don't cook anything with these popsicles. You cut up some fresh fruit, you put them in a popsicle mold or even an old-fashioned kid's Dixie cup, and you add a wooden stick, and you're good to go.
I love these popsicle molds that you have. They're silicone. You just squeeze
they
them from the bottom.
They are so cool. No sticks at all. Yeah. So.
Oh, wait, you guys. I'm so sorry.
This is
but
competitive,
I'm sorry.
Isn't it?
No, it is, because guess what I've got? It's the You're Fired from Mitchell's Ice Cream. It is passion fruit sorbet with a fresh jalapeno.
Kick. Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
For
you don't
the
have to be too
Trump.
Afraid of it. Right.
Oh, wow.
Is
it's
your mouth on
got
fire,
a kick.
Robin?
I would never eat a jalapeno anyway, but in ice cream, that's wild. And just real quick, Mike, the elephant tracks.
It's a chocolate peanut butter base. We add Spanish peanuts and our own homemade brownies, which may be my favorite thing that...
I'm gonna have to eat this to douse the jalapeno.
That's the idea.
Kathy, what do you think of that?
I think it's a tie, okay? I'm competitive, too. I think it's a tie. I'm going to leave you some popsicles for when you get back, and you tell me.
Jalapeno in ice cream.
Sure. You could add chili powder to the watermelon lime popsicle. It would be really cool. A little bit of spice. People add booze to popsicles, a little tequila, white rum.
I think it's safe to say we've got unity in our love for these absolutely fantastic, cool summer treats. We've been talking cool summer treats with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Guntz. We will have all of Kathy's recipes as usual, as well as information on Mitchell's ice cream.
Oh,
sounds
man.
Delicious at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thank you so much
as
always.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm going to eat, so signing off, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young in Cleveland. Mike Wynn, Mitchell's, thank you so much. It's Here and Now.
Thank you.